This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll get the inside perspective from a former FBI agent on the recent so-called homegrown terrorism plot in New York City.
It's probably not the first so-called homegrown terrorism plot in the United States. But one thing it has in common with many of the other so-called plots is they're basically plots carried out at the behest of FBI and state and city informants. There may not be any fire after all this smoke.
We'll also hear excerpts from speeches from the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice. Stay with us. Last week, longtime National Lawyers Guild member Susan B. Jordan was killed in a plane crash in southern Utah. Susan became committed to the civil rights movement at an early age when she volunteered to register voters in Mississippi in the 1960s. She practiced in the Bay Area for many years and came to prominence in the 1970s when she represented two women who had been subpoenaed to testify in the Patty Hearst trial. She gained fame for a landmark case of rape victim Inez Garcia, who was convicted of killing one of her attackers. In a 1977 retrial, Susan won Garcia's acquittal on the grounds that she acted in self-defense, using for the first time what is now widely known as the battered women defense. Attorney Lynn Stewart recently wrote about Susan, quote, "Personally, after I was falsely convicted of material aiding terrorism in February 2005, it was necessary for me to put together a team of lawyers who would represent me at sentencing and fight the government's outrageous demand of 30 years. Susan and I had first met personally at the National Lawyers Guild convention in 2002. She was writing an article about my case, which later appeared in Guild Notes and in the San Francisco Law Journal. It was a friendship that was preordained. At the end of 3 hours of interview, laughter, exchanging war stories, exploring mutual friends, Susan smiled her beautiful smile and said heartily, 'You're my new best friend.' Indeed, it was to be so for the entire time of my trial, my fight with breast cancer, she accompanied me to the hospital for the follow-up to the mammogram, and its sentencing. The legal team I had asked to represent me consisted of Joshua Dreitel, Jill Shello, Ellen Yaroshevsky, Liz Fink, and Susan. Each one of these lawyers had sterling qualities, but it was apparent at times that teamwork was not their forte. Something about legal egos, mine included." Susan transcended the turmoil, and whether it was her Buddhist belief or her Zen and yoga training, she was the force that made it possible for us all to work together and ultimately submit to the court a memorandum that resulted in the 30 years becoming a 28-month sentence. She labored for hours, in person and coast to coast with me, in the preparation of a statement to the judge that accurately portrayed my thinking and feelings, which I now realize I could never have done without her. And now she is gone. It does not fill the void to comment on the length of her exemplary life and career, for she still had miles to go before she slept. I last saw her at the Lawyers Guild dinner honoring Steve Bingham in Oakland, California last month. We were able to talk only for minutes, but we planned to see each other in New York City, or she would fly us up to Eureka in her beloved Mooney. Now that is never to be. I miss Susan presently and forever. As my mentor, my sister lawyer, but mostly as a kindred spirit. Loving life and fighting for justice. Susan B. Jordan, presente.
We all awoke to see that the New York City police and the FBI had arrested four relatively young ex-prisoners for various plots. One part of the plot was to blow up some synagogues, or at least put explosives in the front of synagogues. Another plot was supposedly to use a Stinger missile to bring down a plane that was on its way, or might have been on its way at some point, from Stewart Air Force Base in upstate New York to Afghanistan or Iraq. It was announced with great fanfare by the FBI and the New York State Police, front pages of all the papers, our own homegrown terrorist plots, sleeper cells, whatever you want to call it, in the United States. But when you started getting into the details of the story, it didn't look like we really had four homegrown jihadists here. What we had was an FBI informant who'd been previously convicted of fraud, apparently was also an informant in other cases, and there seems to be strong suggestions that this so-called plot really unfolded at the behest of the FBI informant. Today, I'm excited to have as our guest Michael German, an ACLU attorney and a former FBI agent for 16 years, who analyzes this so-called plot and I think comes to at least the tentative conclusion that there's a lot less here than meets the eye. Michael German, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Mike, you're an ex-FBI agent. You're an attorney with the ACLU. Your desk follows questions like this latest situation in Newburgh, where four people indicted for supporting terrorism. I have to say that my reaction to reading the newspaper articles on this was just utter shock that they would engineer such a crude entrapment. What's your take on it?
Well, you know, typically what I do on these is completely ignore the news stories and go straight to the indictment. And there were a couple of things in the indictment that really were quite shocking to me. One was the indictment made clear that the informant was convicted in a fraud scheme, which goes to typically their truthfulness and for the FBI to utilize an informant who'd been convicted in a matter that goes to the person's truthfulness, I think, is a little troubling from the beginning. But also that the informant met the subjects in a mosque. You may know the Muslim and Arab community have been very concerned about the FBI sending informants, particularly informants with criminal records, into mosques. And you know, sending a criminal into any house of worship seems like a very misguided approach to take from the very beginning. So, you know, right away I had some concerns, and then the press has done a good job. I think, you know, over the years they've developed a healthy skepticism of some of the claims made in these initial press reports and actually had done some digging, and there's certainly a lot to be concerned about. And, you know, obviously a lot more has to come out as this moves forward in the criminal trials, but you know, certainly the initial picture isn't pretty.
Well, Mike, I saw the headline on the New York Post, which isn't exactly a liberal paper, and they got it right on this one, though. The headline was Jihad on Us, and they went on to describe how this informant was giving these four hapless ex-cons bags of marijuana, which they went on to resell. He volunteered to pay for the liver transplant operation of one of these guys' uncles. He'd come and try to seduce them in his Mercedes with his flash and power. I mean, the whole thing really smelled. The thing that really struck me was that he told them that he would be able to facilitate their buying a ground-to-air missile to shoot a plane out of the air at Stewart Air Force Base. It seems to me, and you tell me your legal opinion, but it seems to me you got to be pretty loose about the law of entrapment to try to nail conviction on something like that.
Right, and certainly it seems like whatever threat somebody can later argue existed, it certainly wasn't that these guys were, as you said, hapless, unemployed guys were going to come across a surface-to-air missile anytime soon, so that the FBI was actually bringing all the heavy weaponry is a problem, you know, because it sort of makes these people much more dangerous than they ever would have been. And again, reading the indictment, it's almost comical because due to the intervention of the FBI, they were able to acquire this, you know, supposed plastic explosives and this missile. But then there was, you know, a number of paragraphs about their troubles in locating a pistol. you know, and that these guys, you know, left to their own devices, weren't even able to find a gun in New York City.
That's pretty remarkable.
It's sort of a clue that perhaps these weren't people that were actually going to be successful, certainly not in getting a surface-to-air missile.
And the surface-to-air missile, which was to apparently hit a plane or something like that, leaving Stewart Air Force Base with supplies to Afghanistan or Iraq or somewhere. And, you know, I follow this stuff closely. I had no idea that Stewart Air Force Base is being used to carry weapons or supplies to the U.S. war efforts in the Middle East and Central Asia, et cetera. So the only way these guys would have ever known that, I presume, is the FBI.
Right. And you know, clearly it's the informant, you know, again, just reading through the indictment, who introduced the terrorist organization into the discussion. You know, it wasn't that these guys came to the informant and said, we have this terrorist organization we're supporting and we need your help. It was the opposite, that the informant said, I represent a terrorist organization and need your help, which is a very different sort of thing.
Mike German from the ACLU, let me ask you this with respect to the law of entrapment. What is that law? What kind of predisposition does someone have to have when the government is doing a sting operation in order to find that someone guilty of a crime?
Well, I mean, you basically said it. I mean, bottom line is you don't want the government inventing a crime and then enticing otherwise innocent people into that crime. The argument against that is that the persons were predisposed to commit the crime and the government simply presented the opportunity. And that's where things here get a little dicey because while, you know, maybe these guys weren't the cleanest cut individuals in the community, their ability or interest in engaging in this type of a plot seems to be pretty remote. And the informant seems to have been bringing all the important facts into the game, you know, brings in the idea of this foreign terrorist group that needs help, brings in the access to heavy weapons and explosives. I would think that this is going to be a very interesting case, particularly where, again, the informant comes in with the baggage of having a prior conviction for a fraud-related offense.
Every case is sort of unique, obviously, but it seems to me that this isn't the only time I've heard of this kind of scenario of sort of low-level guys, prisoners, or other people with, you know, that are having difficult times being pushed into some kind of alleged crime by whether it's the FBI or New York State or city police. Does this fit any kind of pattern you've seen in the last few years?
Yes, unfortunately it is. I mean, you can turn to the Liberty 7 case, the Fort Dix case, the Lodi, California case that involve, you know, informants. And coming from that background where I actually worked as an undercover agent, I mean, one of the things that surprises me about these cases is that they seem to, you know, they aren't just sort of one-off. An informant walks in and says, hey, these guys are doing this, and the FBI does a buy bust, and it's over. That these are long-term projects, and I wonder why the FBI doesn't insert undercover agents. I mean, you would think that these would be, you know, the most important cases the FBI is working. And why they wouldn't want to make sure, you know, because typically they want to put in an undercover agent because the undercover agent's motivation is pure, you know, that he's not out there trying to make a few bucks from the government. He doesn't have a criminal record. You know, it's just a lot easier to use an undercover officer. But I think the reason why is because, for the most part, those undercover agents are better trained about entrapment and how not to commit entrapment and also, you know, would not engage in this sort of misconduct that's been alleged here where there seems to be enticements to commit the crime rather than just a documenting of the planning for the crime.
Mike, who's representing these individuals?
In the criminal case?
Right.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I understand it's a legal aid, Heidi. I hope these legal aid lawyers go on the offensive on this and just don't put up a defense, but really go after the government for doing this for obvious reasons, to create fear out there and to keep the whole thing cooking.
And the day that they announced it, of course, was the night of Obama's speech on Guantanamo and all of that. Whether there was coordination or not, we don't know, but it certainly helped in the play that, you know, that we still have serious terrorism problems, we have to worry about it, et cetera. But, you know, I think your point of why they don't use an undercover agent and why they instead use a guy who was convicted of a fraud case and who they then have the goods on and can push around because I guess they suspended his jail sentence or didn't give him one is actually just a key point. Let me ask, I mean, in your cases where you worked as an undercover agent, I guess is what you said at the FBI, How easy did you find it? I mean, you didn't necessarily do this, but how easy would it be to manipulate people like this into some kind of, you know, alleged criminal conduct?
Well, you know, if what's alleged here is true, which is that he was offering money to people to, quote, join his team, in an impoverished community, is pretty easy to entice people into something. So, you know, and that's something that I would think an FBI undercover agent wouldn't do, at least not one that was at all concerned about his career.
So you're saying that this is really being done outside of what a normal undercover agent would do?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, there are officers.
Again, the facts will have to come out in the trial as to what the justification was for initiating the investigation in the first place and whether there was some documented history of predisposition of the people involved. But, you know, the press has been very good about going out and interviewing people in the community. And, you know, one of the things in trying to figure out where the truth lies, where the stories are consistent is usually somewhere closer to the truth. And the type of money that was being talked about by different witnesses in these news stories was all about the same, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 to join the team. Well, that's an awful lot of money. And, you know, if you're out of work, you know, right, it's kind of hard to turn that down.
Sure.
Mike, I also wanted to make another observation. You said before that it was really offensive to send these people into a mosque, and I agree. But I think there's another manipulation of religious stereotypes, too, and that's trying to set them up to blow up a temple and then to try to get sympathy of the Jewish community because they've turned these hapless thugs from Newburgh, these ex-cons, and try to play upon whatever anti-Semitism there may or may not be there, but in any case, turning them against a temple, trying to recruit Jews on the side of this whole fear campaign. I thought that was offensive also.
Right. You know, I mean, there's so much offensive about this. And, you know, the thing is, let's give the FBI the benefit of the doubt on all this stuff, that there was some evidence that documented their predisposition to engage in something. Following through them getting a gun, they're all, I understand, felons. Felon in possession of a handgun is a serious felony. You know, they could have wrapped it up without making it as if this was, you know, saving New York City from this terrible destruction. You know, they didn't have to pump it up to the levels that there's a SAM missile. He could have given them a hand grenade if they had really been asking for weapons, you know, and then it would have been, you know, so it does seem that they were trying to amplify the newsworthiness of this story rather than actually engaging in appropriate law enforcement, you know, taking seriously what may have been a threat. So that part of it really bothers me, that it's, like you said, it was sort of orchestrated to touch certain media buttons where it would get more attention than maybe it deserved.
I'm interested in your first earlier comment about the media. You said you think they've been more skeptical in this case. Can you give us some examples of that? I think that may be right. They didn't just buy the whole thing. The first day, I think they did, but after that, maybe not. I don't know.
Right, yeah. And you know, some of the bloggers, Talking Points Memo, has been on this from day one and really digging and going out and interviewing people in the community. I've seen interviews with people who were at the mosque who were talking about how, yes, we saw this person and we were concerned that he was a government agent because of the way he was acting and asking people to, quote, join his team. And then also family members who were, you know, reflected basically the same thing, that these people were promised money and had certain needs. I understand one of them had a brother who was seriously ill and had said, you know, now I can pay your hospital bills. So
that kind of stuff is really, I mean, you could almost convince me. I mean, if I had a relative or a, you know, son or a daughter or a wife who was really sick and I couldn't help, whether it's a transplant or something, I mean, you know, I wouldn't go that far maybe, but that's serious stuff.
Right. If there was some reason to believe this guy was dangerous and, you know, was really trying to hurt somebody, you wouldn't have to give them a surface-to-air missile and plastic explosives to, you know, address that threat. That there were a lot of other ways they could have done it without trying, you know. I mean, I don't know why they didn't give him a nuclear bomb and say that we gave him a fake nuclear bomb and that he wanted, you know.
They tried that one already with the nuclear bomber.
Well, I just wanted to go back a little bit in terms of the amount of communication or supervision that the informant has with the FBI during the year. They're not out there all on their own. What kind of contact do they have with headquarters?
Well, they should have, you know, in the best of situations, the case informant handler, FBI agent, would have strict control over what the informant was doing. And, you know, the informant wouldn't have any meetings that the FBI agent wasn't recording or at least listening to on a transmitter, so that they could make sure that things were going right. And, you know, we'll have to wait and see once this moves into a criminal trial whether that was the case. You know, the problem is it's not like you can put 24-hour surveillance on the informant, and it's not like the recording devices always work properly. And, you know, there's certainly enough room for an informant to do things, you know, particularly somebody who's otherwise not that trustworthy, to do things that are improper in order to stay in the good graces of the FBI handler by, you know, being able to find crime. And that will be a key element to whether or not an entrapment defense works, because, you know, if there are times when the informant was meeting with these people without an FBI agent being aware of it, certainly I can't imagine that the FBI approved him giving marijuana to the subjects of the investigation, much less that in amounts that they could go out and later sell.
That's true. You know, so
if those allegations turn out to be true, I think that would be devastating to the case.
Mike German, I remember following years ago in the first World Trade Center bombing back in 93, and the informant there was paid something like $1 million. Mohammed Salah, and bought the rented the truck and bought the explosives and so on. And I thought about that when I was reading this article. But I have a legal question for you. I don't know whether you know, and I'm only hazy on it, but I understand that the law of entrapment was really loosened up under judicial right-wing activist Judge Rehnquist back in the early 80s. Are you familiar with that decision?
Well, you know, and again, I'm just sort of working off media reports, but there are some reports that this particular informant had been used in a previous case.
I saw that in the media as well.
And I understand that there were some questions about whether they were completely truthful with the FBI agent involved in that case. And if that's true and the FBI continued to use this person, I would find that as another very troubling aspect, that FBI agents are taught, you know, that even when an informant is working for you, and you know, it's very hard not to become close to them at times where they're taking huge risks on your behalf, but you have to maintain that arm's length distance and realize that these people are making a living by lying to their friends about what they're doing, and they could just as easily be lying to you. And you have to make sure that you have control of them and that they don't have control of the story. So if certainly there is any evidence that this person had been untruthful to the FBI at previous occasions, that would make it very, very difficult to believe that he didn't also stretch the truth in later cases.
How many years were you in the FBI?
16 years.
Wow. And is there a reason that you want to ever mention why you stopped or didn't go on?
Well, yeah, it's pretty much in the public record. I had a falling out with the FBI really over one case in particular, but it was basically after 9/11. I had been working terrorism, mostly domestic terrorism, for about 12 years by the time 9/11 hit, and was very disappointed in the way the FBI responded to that. And I thought that the policies they were adopting were going to be very counterproductive in the end.
What types did you articulate? I mean, did you say at that time or publicly what kinds of policies you disagreed with?
One of the things that's kind of missed in this debate is that, you know, people try to put civil rights and security on a balance where they oppose one another. And what I found is, actually working inside the FBI, is that it's really bureaucratic incompetence that causes problems both for civil rights and for our security. And the type of, you know, let's say that the way the media has reported this story will turn out to be exactly spot on, you know, that it would take incompetent managers to allow this type of activity that would misuse FBI security resources to this sort of fallacious sort of investigation rather than investigating real threats, because, you know, I'm the last person to tell you that there aren't real threats out there. There are, and there are things that the FBI should be focused on rather than sort of creating their own crimes.
I think that's a great statement, actually, and we've just seen so much of that in the last few years, so it's really a pleasure to talk to you, Michael.
Sure, anytime.
We go now to hear speakers from the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice, organized by Revolution Books. Among the speakers were journalist Laura Flanders, attorney Gita Gutierrez from the Center for Constitutional Rights, our own Michael Ratner, president of the center. We hear first from Sister Diana Ortiz, a survivor of torture.
I am here to share my reflections about the life experiences of torture survivors. And certainly one of the obvious experiences we have is that we quickly learn that for the public in general, we don't know anything worth knowing. I ask you to think back to the TV programs, talk shows, print media pieces on the subject, congressional briefings and hearings, and many conferences on the issues of torture, except this one. How many times has a survivor been called upon to offer his or her views on this subject? A subject we know from the inside out. Not many, I assure you. For those who are willing to listen to us, it should soon be obvious that torture leaves no part of a person's life untouched. What I will share with you tonight is drawn from my interactions with fellow survivors over the past decade and a half. While there is no one single model that encompasses all lived experiences of survivors, there are characteristics or effects that are quite common among us. We lived through something unspeakable. At the point of victimization, we begin to die a slow death. We are stripped of our dignity, our sense of control, and our very link with humanity. Trust is gone. Hope is gone. Faith is gone. And security is gone. And we are prepared to say anything we think they want to hear so that they may more quickly kill us. In the words of one Honduran torturer, eventually they all beg to die. For those of us who do not die, what we have lost is replaced with alienation, a sense of betrayal, and a terrible fear. A metamorphosis takes place. Though technically alive, we feel more akin to the dead than to the living. People around us celebrate our survival while we mourn our own deaths. We are strangers to everyone, those closest to us, even to ourselves. We are no longer part of a world where once we felt at home. Listen for a moment to the words of the tortured Austrian philosopher Jean Amaury. Anyone who who has been tortured remains tortured. Anyone who has suffered torture never again will be at ease in the world. Faith in humanity already cracked by the first slap in the face and then demolished by torture is never acquired again. Many of us carry the physical scars of having been beaten, hanged by wrist, arms or legs, burned by electrical devices or cigarettes, cut or stabbed with knives and machetes. Then there are those with permanent head injuries, amputated limbs, and the like. Each mark, visible or invisible, is a lasting reminder of what was done to us, a reminder that often brings embarrassment and even shame. What a cruel irony it is. It is the tortured and not the torturer who feels shame. In 1997, as part of a National Institute of Mental Health working group on the mental health consequences of torture, I spoke with countless survivors. And I remember a young woman who, in addition to being subjected to waterboarding, had been raped daily by her torturers. They left marks on her body, symbolizing their pride of ownership. I lost contact with her, but I thought of her very often. And one day, not so long ago, I heard from her. She had dared to take a risk of letting a person into her life. He knew that she had been treated badly in her country, but he still loved me, she said. And we got married, she continued. Then the sobs came on what was to be an important moment in their life together. Her husband saw for the first time her breast. One of her torturers had bitten off her nipples. Another had branded his initials into her breast. When her husband saw her body, he left the room, never returning. While the physical act of torture may be assigned to the past, its psychological effects permeate the present and blight the promise of the future. So often, this is torture's intention. Torture is an attempt to obliterate a person's personality, to turn him or her into a quivering mass of fear, cowering in some corner of the world, afraid to look for the dawn. Torture does not end with the release from some clandestine prison, and it's not going to end for those who someday may be released from Guantanamo. It is not something we get over. It is forever, forever strapped to our backs. It constitutes a permanent invasion of our minds and our souls. Someone in uniform, a scream, the smell of a cigarette, perspiration, urine, whistling, heavy breathing, dripping water, clattering of keys, the sight of a dog, simply being in a cold, bright room, even making eye contact, being photographed, or a friendly embrace, any of them threaten to return us to that past which walks so closely behind us. Imagine for a moment what it's like to be shadowed by these images day in and day out.
That was Sister Deanna Ortiz speaking at the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice. We now hear from Jeremy Scahill, from the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice, organized by Revolution Books.
You know, I always find it incredibly humbling to listen to attorneys who've been the real freedom fighters in this society during this incredibly dark period in our history. People like Geeta and Michael and their colleagues, those that are at Guantanamo right now, and people like Clive Stafford Smith, the incredibly heroic lawyer. Their jobs in this society, the work that they're doing right now, would be largely unnecessary if we had an actual opposition party in this country. If we had an actual movement that had a spine and was not itself complicit in the torture, funding it, voting for it, staying silent when they know that it's happening. Nancy Pelosi can fumble for that statement that some aide wrote for her all she wants, but the fact is that she and other leaders of the Democratic Party knew damn well that this torture was happening, and they either were mute in the face of this overwhelming evidence. They could have picked up the phone and called any number of those attorneys who win a lot of mainstream civil liberties organizations, wouldn't do it. We're actually taking the personal risk of defending those people that were being described by officials in Washington as the most heinous individuals who'd ever walked planet Earth. We wouldn't need people like Michael and Geeta to be fighting these battles if those whose responsibility it is to prevent those kinds of actions from taking place actually were doing their jobs. So I want to say that at the onset, because as we discuss the specific cases of torture, as Geeta just did and as Michael will later, and as we talk about the failure on the part of the Obama administration thus far to hold any of the criminals who thought up these programs, who gave the orders to implement the torture, and those who did the torture themselves, not a single one of these individuals has faced any form of justice whatsoever for the crimes that they've committed in the names of every person in this country. The fact is that people act gobsmacked, they act shocked that this is happening right now, stunned that there's an escalation of the war in Afghanistan. Obama's disappointing us. I get that email every day, oh, Obama was the great disappointment. Obama telegraphed his passes the entire time he was running for office. Let me break down a few things that are happening in the world right now. In Iraq, we have a slightly downsized occupation that has been rebranded by the Obama administration. We have an escalation of the war in Afghanistan, where there could potentially be 78,000 U.S. troops by next year. You have a man who's just been named the commander of operations in Afghanistan, who not only was one of the central people in covering up the killing of Pat Tillman by other U.S. soldiers and making it look like he was killed in an insurgent attack, but this individual, McChrystal, also was one of the leaders of the teams in Iraq that were hunting down so-called insurgents and partaking in extrajudicial executions of these individuals with no trial, no due process whatsoever, and then running secret prisons in contravention of the Geneva Convention and not allowing the Red Cross to visit prisoners. That's the man Obama has chosen now to run operations in Afghanistan. They have that abomination of a U.S. embassy in Baghdad that recently opened that was built on slave labor and is bigger than any embassy in the history of the world, 500 CIA operatives alone operating out of it. It's the size of Vatican City. The Vatican, of course, has embassies in other countries. We have an embassy the size of the Vatican in Iraq right now. The U.S. just announced plans to build a massive colonial-type fortress in Islamabad, Pakistan, that's going to be one of the hubs of U.S. operations for a long time. But don't mention the word occupation in conjunction with Afghanistan. We're just there for U.S. national security. Well, the fact is that Obama campaigned on a lot of things that involved fierce rhetoric. But he also campaigned pretty honestly about what he was going to do in the world. And that, I think, is the challenge for all of us, is to actually own up to the fact that we could have seen the writing on the wall when it was there, coming out of the mouth of the man that was running on this campaign of change. He said he was going to do all of these things. I recently obtained documents from the Pentagon that show that in Iraq, there's a 23% increase in the first quarter of 2009 in the number of armed mercenaries that are operating in Iraq. Now, the Pentagon says that's because they're doing better accounting right now. They can count them. Obama didn't continue Blackwater's contract, but instead hired another company called Triple Canopy, which has a notoriously atrocious human rights record, and then a bunch of the Blackwater guys were just rehired by Triple Canopy. So there you have the change we can believe in Iraq. In Afghanistan, 29% increase in the number of armed U.S. mercenaries working for for-profit corporations benefiting off of bloodshed and violence. In Afghanistan, they're very explicit about it. They say that it's consistent with the troop buildup there. At present, there are 250,000 contractors operating in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. That constitutes half of the entire force that CENTCOM has fighting those two occupation wars. Half of them are working for for-profit corporations. When it comes to Guantanamo, one of the things that I'm sure it's only because Geeta ran out of time, that she wasn't able to really highlight, and I know she talks about this a lot, the torture's ongoing at Guantanamo. It's not like, you know, Dick Cheney ordered waterboarding and all the Democrats just were shocked that it happened, and then now it doesn't happen anymore because Obama issued that edict after his inauguration. Here's a fact that is undeniable. Torture is happening right now at Guantanamo. Torture is happening right now at Guantanamo. And one of the reasons why it's happening is because there has been a systematic failure and refusal to hold the torturers accountable. They have nothing to lose by continuing to brutalize these prisoners. I recently did a story for Alternet that has gotten absolutely no attention in the corporate press, where I looked in depth into the operations of these teams that operate at Guantanamo called the Immediate Reaction Force. The prisoners and their lawyers call them the Extreme Repression Force. This is not the interrogators. These are not the guys doing the waterboarding. This is a force whose entire role at Guantanamo is to terrorize prisoners who resist in the slightest bit anything that they're told by anyone in authority there. You take an extra styrofoam cup because you want to write a poem on it. They call in these five-man thug squads dressed in what Clive Stafford Smith calls Darth Vader outfits. They're each assigned, the five of them, each assigned a body part of the prisoner, the head, the left arm, the right arm, the left leg, the right leg. They douse them with a chemical agent. They go in. The first guy in with the shield slams the guy to the ground. They take them. They hogtie them and sometimes leave them hogtied like that. If it's not good enough to brutalize them in that fashion, they also do things like placing their heads in toilets and repeatedly flushing the toilet. They take the feces from one prisoner and smear it in the face of another. One guard, after Obama's inauguration, urinated on the head of one of the prisoners represented by the Center for Constitutional Rights. This is happening not under Commander-in-Chief George Bush, but it's happening under Commander-in-Chief Barack Obama. And while he issued that executive order on the 22nd or 23rd of January, saying that the United States was going to close Guantanamo and that it was going to respect the Geneva Conventions, every day there's a violation of the Geneva Conventions because they are abusing prisoners. They are being punitive against them with physical violence for nonviolent offenses on the part of the prisoners. These teams that are torturing people at Guantanamo, sticking hoses up to their nose and turning it on at full blast, ramming tubes to force-feed prisoners on a hunger strike down into their stomach, yanking them out with no anesthetic, and then reinserting them into the nose of another prisoner without taking any time to even clean it off. One prisoner said in the CCR report, that's torture, torture, torture. Just being force-fed itself is an act of torture at Guantanamo. These are not the teams that did the waterboarding. These were not the guys who were sitting there with the contractors and others trying to think of a new sadistic way to mangle this human being's insides or outsides. These are pure and simple thug squads. Michael Ratner, when I interviewed him for this story, said they're the black shirts of Guantanamo. And he didn't say that in December of 2008. He said that 2 weeks ago, talking about a force that continues to operate there. So we have all of this information, and I'm glad that Gita did something that probably made some people uncomfortable, because the fact is an event like this, especially with attorneys on the front lines of this struggle, should be jam-packed. There should be a line circling around the block. But you know what's happened in this society is that you have, I get email all the time from people telling me to shut up, give it up, move on, it's over, give the guy a chance. You don't give a guy a chance who's allowing torture to continue. Not as a journalist and not as a responsible citizen in this society. You don't give power a chance to continue abusing people in your name. And so while there may be only a few people in this crowd, and we know there are a lot of people on the outside that maybe in good faith think, well, Obama's going to change everything and we elected him, so our work is done. I'm fond of saying this, and I feel like I say it all the time, but it's so true. Kathy Kelly, the great human rights activist who right now is in Pakistan, risking her life under the threat of drone bombardments by the United States, said that you can't be anti-war between Republican administrations any more than you can be a vegetarian between meals. In other words, you need to stand up even when that guy you like, if you like him, happens to be the president of the United States, especially when those individuals are in power. And so, in closing, what I want to say is I recently read an article in a neocon Zionist publication of JINSA, which is one of the leading neocon organizations, written by a retired colonel named Ralph Peters. And in this article, he was calling for the United States in future wars to attack militarily what he called partisan media. He literally meant to bomb journalists who were combatants because they were reporting facts that were inconvenient to the U.S. propaganda machine. And it's there for you to read. You can see it. He laid this out explicitly. Well, first of all, the United States has been attacking journalists for a very long time. Al Jazeera's offices were bombed in Afghanistan in 2001, as were the BBC's. Tariq Ayub, the Al Jazeera correspondent, was killed by U.S. warplanes as he reported on the battle for Baghdad in April of 2003. The Sheraton Hotel in Basra was bombed when Al Jazeera were the only guests staying there. The Palestine Hotel was bombed, killing Jose Cuso, the Spanish cameraman, and one of his Ukrainian colleagues from Reuters. The United States has killed over a dozen journalists that we know of in Iraq, over 120 media workers in all have been killed in that war. The United States bombed radio television Serbia under Bill Clinton in 1999, killing 16 journalists. The reason I'm bringing this up at the end is to answer the challenge that Gita put forward at the beginning. Those people who felt like they had a spine under Bush, who were standing up to those crimes under Bush, there's a simple challenge for you. Be the exact same person you were then. Be it then when there's only five people in a crowd instead of the 500 that would show up when it was in vogue or popular to wear an Arrest Bush t-shirt. Now, and I mean that in the greatest sense of the terms to Lori, who's been out there for a very long time with all the spine in the world. But the fact is that these crimes are ongoing, and we have journalists now who are acting as sort of blue state fox, where all of a sudden they were critical at the end of Bush, and now it's Obama, so we got to lay off the guy, let him do his thing. No, his thing looks a lot like Bush's thing. And so we all have to pledge to be the same resistors that we were when it was popular to be so. That's when your conscience actually shines through. And until we realize that all of this is the product of false faith in a one-party system, we're never going to get anywhere in this country. Thank you.
That was Jeremy Scahill speaking at the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice. We'll now hear from Michael Ratner.
Thank you all for being here. And I want to really echo what Gita began with. This is a time, really, in which when you leave this hall, that you have to go and do something about what you've heard and what you've seen, whether it's on CCR's website, where there's actions, or others. It's really a time, a serious time, when it's gone on too long, and a time for action. I was really pleased to have with us, although very painfully so, Diana Ortiz. And what... I mean, I know we all weep when we hear Diana, but what her presence here really signifies to me is what's absent in the entire 7 or 8 years where this country has run an open and notorious torture program. And that's the absence of the survivors of that program. And I think what a difference it would make in this country if we could have the mothers of Guantanamo outside the White House every single day. It's wonderful to have the people in the jumpsuits, but the reason this torture debate, if you want to call it that, is so foolishly ignorant and stupid is because it's a debate among people who are not the survivors of torture. And so I really want to thank Diana, because I know, as you could see, it's not easy for her to go back through what happened to her and to talk about it. But it's really important for all of us to hear it. So thank you, Diana. Diana's case also is the Guatemala torture in the 80s. It also tells us really what Andy was saying, that when you hear this debate about we need torture to get information, we don't need torture. I mean, they do need torture to get the false information they use to get us into the Iraq War, but that's a different issue. But when you talk about getting information and this debate about it, what the Guatemala cases illustrate really vividly, and what Diana's case in particular, is that torture is not about information. It's about domination and oppression. And it's about domination and oppression, whether it's in Guatemala, Afghanistan, or Iraq, and domination and oppression in our police precincts in the United States, or in our prisons in the United States. It's not about information. So while, yes, we have to call to abolish torture, to prosecute the last set of the torture conspirators who have just left office, it's absolutely necessary, that the causes of torture, and torture itself is not some slogan to simply say abolish torture, we have to actually ultimately get rid of the causes and the system that sets up a government that tortures people not only in this country, but all over the world. The other impression I had in listening, of course, you heard Gita, and she mentioned the suicide at Guantanamo that took place yesterday. It really, when I thought about this man who was 31 years old, been there for 7 years, weighed at one point 87 pounds because he was on a hunger strike, finally somehow figuring out how to take his own life. It's just devastating. And it's devastating, you understand now, that this is no longer Bush's Guantanamo. This is President Barack Obama's Guantanamo. And when that man takes his life, that's on President Barack Obama's hands. It's not any longer Bush's hands. And when we talk about, and you know, there's a big case that's always talked about, the Uyghurs. The Uyghurs are the 17 men at Guantanamo from Western China. And they've been declared innocent even by this government and the last government. And they shouldn't be at Guantanamo at all. And the Bush administration kept them there day after day. The courts ordered them released. First the Bush administration and then the Barack Obama administration said he would not parole them into the country, which he could do. So they have now been there 4 months, innocent men under this current administration. We fight in this country to get people out of prison then when they're down at what we used to call the Tombs, but 100 Center Street, for one night. And these men, day after day, week after week, Obama, with a stroke of the pen, could bring them into Washington where they would be living with other Uyghur families, and he hasn't done it. So again, I want to say the innocent and the others at Guantanamo are now really in Barack Obama's hands, and it is his Guantanamo. You know, back in the days when George Bush was president, we at the center took very, very strong positions on the issues we've been talking about tonight. We took strong positions that Guantanamo must be closed. And by closed, I don't just mean physically closed, but I mean getting rid of the policies, the practices, and the unlawfulness that underlies what Guantanamo is. We said that detainees had to either be charged in court or repatriated to their countries. No third way, no preventive detention. We said that those to be tried, whatever the number, whether it's 10 or 15, it's a small number of the 240 remaining, had to be tried in federal courts, no military commissions. We said that torture had to be ended completely, no exceptions, no matter what. We said that those officials in this government responsible for torture had to be investigated and prosecuted by a special prosecutor. Those were five clear demands that the progressives were making, lawyers even representing the Guantanamo detainees were making, many of us were making in the Bush administration. The principles underlying those demands, they aren't Democratic principles, they aren't Republican principles, they're fundamental principles.
That was Michael Ratner speaking at the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice, organized by Revolution Books. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.